Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name's Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. If you're just tuning in for the first time, you should know you can find more of our episodes at GameofThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us and let us know what you think of the podcast and of the show at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. If you don't know what we do here, we will spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones, talk about everything through the episode, and that does not include, however, anything from future weeks, future book developments, or the next time on preview that HBO likes airing after the show. This week, we're going to be spoiling everything through Season 4, Episode 2, entitled The Lion and the Rose. So we'll be spoiling everything through this week's episode, The Lion and the Rose. And what a consequential episode this was, Joanna Robinson.
I know. I mean, we finally got to see Stannis again, and I've been missing him so much.
Seriously. Well, Stannis' wife is really the big...
Yes.
That is a big... She becomes so much less appealing in this episode. You know what I'm saying?
If that were possible. Yeah.
And that is like... Not to mention we got to see Bran again after so long.
I've been missing him, man.
So many... shockwaves that sent through the Game of Thrones community. So, a lot of good stuff to cover, guys. I'm really looking forward to breaking it all down with you guys. But Joanna, before we start, we always like to go through feedback from last week's episode, follow up from last week's episode. And, you know, Joanna Robinson, we like to talk about at the beginning of each episode how you've read all the books from George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. And the thing is... I don't know if you know this, but every time you forget a single detail out of, let's say, I don't know, 2,000 to 3,000 pages worth of book reading, it really infuriates me, which is why it makes me really similar to our listeners. when you forget a detail, I'm just like, how could you do that, Joanna Robinson? Like, you have
it's a betrayal. It's a fundamental betrayal.
It feels like a betrayal of trust. I put my trust in you. I put my trust in your encyclopedic knowledge. And when you show human weakness, it really makes me want to come down upon you like Joffrey on his wedding cake. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just really... It upsets me. It upsets our listeners. But no, in all seriousness, though, I am very forgiving. But people have written in. Sometimes mistakes do happen. So we got a couple things wrong last week, right, Joanna Robinson? One of them was I asked a question about why is it there's all these dead people on these signposts on the way to Meereen, right?
Yeah.
I feel
like people are nicer this year than they have been in years past. Like, maybe I've built up some... stock with people, but I feel like people used to get much angrier. But yes, the children, the slave children, nailed to every mile marker on the way to Meereen was a warning to Dany.
She's been going on a slave freeing expedition, and so they're like, yeah,
yes, she's Abe Lincolning all over.
Yeah, who ain't nobody got time for that, man. So like,
she's like Team America World Policing.
Right.
Essos, so,
exactly. So,
yeah.
Get off me, I think, is what they're saying by killing all these people and stringing them up like that.
Right. Right.
So wanted to point that out. A lot of people chimed in with theories as to why Tywin is choosing now to melt the swords from Season 4, Episode 1. And so there's a lot of various theories about that. I mean, I think in the book it's probably explained a little bit better, but a lot of people are extrapolating from the book to the show, which is... not a totally safe thing to do. But yeah, a lot of theories, like, for example, like he's finally defeated Robb Stark, so that sort of era is over and he can feel good melting down the sword. You know, some people pointed that out. But
long it would take the blacksmith to get there from Volantis, all those other stuff. So
right.
Yeah.
So thank you guys for chiming with those theories. I don't know that any of them is 100% verified truth, but there are a lot of interesting theories out there about why he chose not to melt the swords. What else? So true to my promise last week, I actually did create a video essay in which I analyzed the musical choices for the end of last week's episode and sort of put different music on to try to see how it would create a different mood. And I posted this on our Facebook page, which you can follow us on, at facebook.com/acastofkings. And so if you want to see like my insane rantings in video form, just follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/acastofkings, and you'll see the video.
Who doesn't? Who doesn't want to follow your insane ranting?
Exactly. I know you. I know you can't get enough of them. So check that video out. But unsurprisingly, a lot of people did not agree with my findings. In fact,
what?
I don't think a single person agreed with what I said. Like, I've read lots of comments, and I don't recall reading a single person that said, "Hey, Dave, you're right on. I agree with you." This email came in from Kes from Australia, who wrote in about the music at the end of last week's episode. The perversion – I'm going to just jump around this email here. "The perversion of Game of Thrones theme is an extension of the perversion of Arya, Westeros' last innocent. For three seasons, we've seen Arya be the tough, knowledgeable little urchin, defiant, headstrong, deeply loyal, and committed to her cause. We felt a childlike thrill at seeing her learn swordplay, felt pride at her natural leadership with other children, got gooey at her blossoming relationship with the Hound. There was never doubting her passion nor our desire to see her family avenged, but she was always coming from a childishly naive space." And so I'm skipping forward here. "What we saw in this episode in unflinchingly long wides was a child killer be born. Her first kill was a relatively spontaneous act of passion. Red Wedding, a recent burning event, but this was something else entirely. She dragged the two of them into it. Now, dropped into the action, watching, for all she knows, her only comrade and salvation in peril, Arya must at last enlist her training and with foresight and deliberation, kill like she's always wanted. The sword sinks in with unstoppable deadly force. On her face, a mix of elation, adrenaline, and purpose. The slash to the back of the knees in gracious feline style. Words she's had ringing inside her soul delivered before another brutally surgical stabbing. A slow, drawn-out death watched in cold satisfaction as she allows her demons to claim her at long last. Then, she has a presumably dead man's horse. She wears a smile that's also a scowl. She has her sword. Here is new vision of Arya as she rides into the kingdom she should know and love while it burns, ravaged and broken by the spreading infection of the Lannisters. And playing beneath it all, the triumphant song, quote-unquote, we know and love, slowed right down and filled with synthy dread. There is a line that's been crossed with Arya's murderous cherry pop. We have borne witness to his child psychopath. And even in a cruel medieval time such as these, that's a rarity." End quote. It goes on. It's a really great email from Kes here.
Great email. Really.
Yeah. But so what do you think of this email? I mean, do you agree that that we're seeing the Game of Thrones theme perverted in the same way we're seeing Arya's sort of ethical compass perverted? Moral compass, I should say?
I don't know. Like, I still stick by what I said last week. But I also liked what people said about the burnt-out landscape that you see at the end of the episode.
People were basically saying that this isn't triumphant at all because they're riding into a burnt-out landscape. Like,
or that at least the burnt-out landscape undercuts that triumphant note.
Right.
I don't think they're trying to rob us of cheering for Arya to a certain degree. I just think that your feelings should be mixed. And, you know, I think that was articulated well in that email. And I don't know. And maybe, you know, book knowledge informs that, or maybe it doesn't, or I have no idea, you know, how my approach is different than yours and why this is, I don't know, so very troubling for you.
I didn't
mean that to dismiss it. I'm
what
sorry.
A condescending way to put that.
I know, that was really dicey. I didn't mean it that way. But just, you know, like, I don't know. Like I said, when you showed me the video, I think it's a great video. And if you haven't seen it yet, you should, at least for some of the other musical cues that Dave picked out. But I still stick by my opinion. So,
yeah, I mean, I think these people have really brought up some great points. Yeah, people pointing out the bombed out landscape. Winterfell still shows up in the opening credits, even though we haven't seen it in quite some time. But you know, and there's also this question of like the bad fan, right? And can you be a bad fan? Is there such a thing as a bad fan, or like is Westeros just so morally ambiguous that you can just root for anyone, and like you can't possibly be a bad fan because everyone is so morally compromised that asking you to not root for anyone is an unreasonable request. I don't know. I don't have the final answer. I'm not like super convinced on this.
No, but at the very least, and also I should say, at the very least, it's fun and interesting to remember. You're always so good at picking up score details that I miss. And especially when we were podcasting about Breaking Bad, like you sort of blew my mind wide open about paying attention to the score. And of course I knew that intellectually of how the score affects how we view a scene, but it is sort of remarkable to watch that sequence over and over again with different music underneath it. So,
yeah. And so we'll see. I mean, a lot of people have said in almost spoilery territory that like, that the showrunners know what they're doing with Arya, basically. We'll see. I'm not like 100% decided.
And then she died this week, and it was really shocking because yeah, you did not see that coming.
Agreed. We'll see what happens with the show. I'm willing to wait and see. I wasn't like the only thing I was trying to say is the music matters, and I'm willing to wait further to decide whether the music was the right choice in this case. I think that's all we can say. We'll probably have more to say about the bad fan down the line and whether that's actually a legitimate complaint about a show, you know.
Yeah, I guess some people got a little offended by that, and I can see that.
Yeah, speaking
of condescending things, you're enjoying this wrong, but
I think we have too much to talk about this episode to dive into that, however.
That's true.
I also wanted to point out one email from Phil from New York who made a point, and actually several other people made the point, that like the two swords in the episode from last week, he melted down two swords. One he gave to Jaime, and the other one we found out in this episode he gave to Joffrey. But you know, the two swords could theoretically have referred to both the Jaime sword and also Arya reclaiming Needle, that sword as well, and the symmetry between that. Phil from New York wrote in. A few other people wrote in with that observation as well, so I thought it was worth pointing that out. So, and it was such a unique observation that I used it in the video itself without providing any credit whatsoever. So thank you guys for that. Appreciate it. Jonah, you were going to say something else?
Well, sort of what you just mentioned before that ties into a storyline. I don't know which storyline you want to start with in this episode, but can I
go
make a suggestion?
Make the connection.
That would be the Theon stuff this week, because I wanted to ask, I've been dying to ask you, in my opinion, Alfie Allen did an amazing job this episode of showing us a broken version of a character that we already know. And as I told everyone last season on this podcast, that's something that's done off screen in the books. You just see Theon shows up again and you see him already broken and you don't see the breaking. You sort of hear about it in flashbacks. And so I know that you and I both had some problems with the Theon plot last season, but I felt it was paid off well in this episode. And I'm wondering if you think they could have accomplished the same thing without showing it. Or would you have had a different frustration, which is that you didn't see how Theon got to where he was?
Yeah, I think I more agree with that one. I mean, so at first when I saw the opening scene where they hunt down this girl, what's her name again?
Tansy.
When they hunt down Tansy, I don't think we've met until this point in the show. Is that correct?
We hadn't met Tansy, but the girl he was hunting with was one of the two girls who seduced Theon last season.
I see. So good catch, by the way, Joanna. Initially when I watched this, I was thinking to myself, oh man, wow, this show really made me look like an idiot, because all that character stuff that happened with Theon last season, that really all paid off here, didn't it? And then later on, I realized that no, that's complete garbage. Our complaints about last season were still completely legitimate, because the breaking down that you see, you only really get a hint of that from last season, right? Like, sure, he goes through all this torture, but essentially they have brainwashed Theon, right? And we only get a glimpse of that in the last episode of last season.
Right.
There's still a ton of brainwashing stuff that happens off screen. So I feel like the one thing that I would say that is kind of paid off is the cruelty of Ramsay Snow needs no explanation whatsoever. Like, that's not something that comes out of nowhere. It's kind of something that we understand as viewers because we've seen it copiously displayed last season. But beyond that, this whole idea about Theon being brainwashed and now he is completely helpless and doesn't even want to hurt Ramsay, or maybe he doesn't want, maybe he wants to hurt Ramsay, but he doesn't have the will to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Which is totally bizarre because at this point, Theon, I'm guessing he probably feels he has nothing to lose. So that he would be reduced to the phase, the stage where he wouldn't even want to kill Ramsay, even if it would mean his own death, is just, it requires, there's like a whole nother season worth of Theon torture that we were not witness to. So I get, to me, it reinforces our complaints in that, like, you could have compressed it down and you still would have lost nothing because all the stuff that you're paying off now is only stuff you hinted at last season. So you didn't need to subject us to all that torture. So that's
I don't
my,
know that I don't understand that. I don't know that I follow that logic because you're saying they didn't show enough, so they should have showed less.
Yeah, that's correct. Oh, I guess what I'm saying is the stuff that you wanted them to pay off is not stuff they ended up showing. They ended up showing all this unnecessary torture stuff. And I feel like the crucial part about Theon breaking, I don't feel like was adequately conveyed last season. That is me. That is me.
Okay. Okay.
All I saw was like them brutally hurting him. I mean, I
but
guess
it wasn't just brutally hurting him. He's like, he couldn't sleep. They thought he was going to escape and he was taken back. You know, they took his penis, you know, like, and I don't know enough about torture and brainwashing to know, you know, the exact process by which you break down someone's will, but you know, the constant bait and switch that Ramsay was pulling on Theon, I don't know. It wasn't just they physically hurt him. He messed with his head constantly. So I don't know. But can we agree that Alfie Allen was great in this episode?
Oh, he was fantastic. And okay, yeah. So let me walk some of that back then. You know, I guess I'm saying it out loud what my impulse was, and I guess hearing you talk about it and hearing you debate it, I do feel like there is some validity to it. I don't know. I just.
But I still agree with you that it didn't feel like it fit. But
right,
I don't
because,
know how
because,
they could have gotten away with showing us any less. Because not for the reason you put it. I'm just saying like last season we were watching, it's like, oh, we felt dragged back to the Theon plot line. But I feel like they had to show that in order for us to understand where Theon's coming from in this episode.
Right. Like if they had showed less torture, right, would we have been less willing to accept that Theon would be reduced to this state?
Right. I feel like you would have been even more upset that they didn't connect the dots well enough. Maybe.
Yeah, it's a valid point, but I guess I feel like let's put it this way. It is a difficult mix. It's difficult to figure out exactly what the right amount you show is because there's a bunch that you're going to hint at, right?
Right.
That he went through this whole brainwashing that you're not going to show. So then, like, how much do you show before that, right? And that is a delicate mix, and I don't know that I have the right answer to that. So I will say that I'm willing to say, you know, I'm not I don't have a clear sort of strong opinion on that one.
Okay.
And, yeah, I went back and forth when I was watching it. I'm going back and forth now. So we'll leave it at that.
Okay.
But great scene, really well done with him like holding the knife up to Ramsay's throat, and yeah, we finally get to see the relationship between Ramsay and Roose, and it does explain a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that, it's all just about sons trying to win the approval of their fathers. That's all that's going on in the show, right?
Exactly,
and they do it in different
simple
ways.
Simple tale.
You know, sometimes you cut some guy's dick off. Sometimes you burn farm boys alive. You know, like it takes different forms. When
you gotta do what you gotta do.
You gotta do what you gotta do. So it seems as though Roose is at first really displeased with Ramsay for messing with Theon, and I took some pleasure in watching Roose dress down Ramsay because we're obviously root for Theon to some degree, even though he has done terrible things. But
if it comes down between Team Ramsay And Team Theon, we're Team Theon.
Team Theon, for sure. So it's fun to watch Roose dress him down, and then heartbreaking to see Theon basically obey everything Ramsay's saying. That was really... That messed with my head, Joanna.
Yeah, it was really upsetting. And to hear and to watch him find out about the Red Wedding.
And not do anything.
Right, and not do anything. And it echoes back, you know, and Ramsay's like, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about hearing about Rob? And it must have been, season two, Balon Greyjoy said, did a similar thing to Theon when he told him about Ned Stark, or they were talking about Ned Stark dying. He's like, how do you feel about that? Like a test. And yeah, I mean, Theon did some terrible things. We all agree. But yeah, this guy has been so manipulated by people around him. So it's pretty upsetting.
So Roose is offering, Roose offers Ramsay an opportunity to kind of redeem himself by taking this critical strategic point against the North. Did I read that correctly?
Right. So Ramsay is supposed to go take Moat Cailin, and then Locke is supposed to go after Bran Rickon, who they're guessing might be sheltered by Jon Snow.
Who is Locke again? Just one of Roose's men. Is that right?
Right. And he's the one who took Jaime's hand.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Even mention it in this episode as like an aside.
Right.
Like,
he was
hey,
you would have been
me?
So psyched to see that. Yeah. It is funny. Yeah. Locke. Also, I just remember him as the dad from Richard Ayoade's Submarine, that movie.
Yes, he's also in Almost Famous, one of my favorite movies.
In which he plays almost a completely opposite character that he is in this movie, in the show, I should say.
Noah Taylor, something like that. Yeah, great guy.
So, a couple of other things I want to point out. Actually, number one, someone in the comment section of this episode, I think, said something along the lines of, "Why is Dave an idiot? He doesn't understand these basic plot points." I found it just by Googling this. And, you know, the point about me not being very smart, that's totally legitimate, but there's a reason that I don't Google things.
Right.
Is because, first of all, I Bing it. And secondly, it's because, dude, there be spoilers, man. Like, you cannot, because the books are out there, the wiki is out there, like, and it covers what book people know. So if I search on the internet for a character, it might tell me when that character is going to die, and I don't even know. See that coming.
You could Google the most basic thing and get super spoiled.
Right, so. Exactly.
So that's supposed to be my job.
That's supposed to be, yes, it's supposed to be Jenna's job, which she fulfills 95% of the time. Yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to explain that. And also, I thought before we like move on in this episode dissection, I thought we should also mention that like, this is an episode that spends a ton of time in one location, which is very rare in the show. I mean, there's been like, what, almost over 30 episodes at this point. And I would say only a few, maybe three or four, have spent the majority of their time in a single location.
Right. Blackwater is a pretty famous example.
Blackwater, I would argue, like the pilot probably spent that's not true. I mean... because we had to introduce ourselves to all the different places in the pilot, but is the Red Wedding one of those as well? Like, I don't recall.
No, I don't think it's quite as much. But I did look at the time when Joffrey and Margaery's wedding started, and it was 29 minutes into the episode.
And I think that like the show really benefits from it. Like for two reasons. Number one, you get to the scenes really get a chance to breathe and play out. But number two, whenever the show spends a long time at one location, you do get a sense of dread, like something, there's a reason this is happening and something terrible is probably going to happen. So I think it works to its favor. How did you feel about the way the show treated time in this episode, Joanna?
Well, I will say someone pointed out that it felt like, you know, we pointed out last week that we didn't see Stannis, Theon, or Bran. And so they're like, okay, we're going to check in with Stannis, Theon, and Bran, and then we're going to do the Purple Wedding, bing, bang, boom. So I felt like that was the seams showing a little bit. You know, it felt like, okay, they had to check these other things off the checklist as well.
Right.
But, you know, if we also talked about how those three plot lines are the ones that are struggling to be the most interesting. I would argue things are maybe changing a little bit with the Ramsay plot line, but... so it's fitting to pair them with maybe one of the most exciting things that's going to happen this season. Maybe. There might be other things that happen. I don't know.
Nicely done, Joanna Robinson. Nicely done. Yeah, really, really fascinating to see how it plays out. I mean, I really liked it, but you do also get a sense that, man, right, these showrunners are really constrained by the format. Like, they have to just bounce around from all these locations every single week. And that is tough. That is tough to do, but they do a good job most of the time. And I think in this episode, they really got to let their true talents at crafting, like, a sequence and have it play out. They really got to let that shine.
Yeah.
All that is to say, we don't have that many plot lines to discuss this week. We only have, like, as you pointed out, like, four. So that we just talked about one. Another one is, what do you call it? The Stannis storyline we revisit. They're burning people alive. We see a little bit more of Stannis' wife. We see Stannis' daughter mouth off to Melisandre. Stannis' wife, by the way, almost as unappealing as Stannis himself. Like, not quite, but totally believes in, you know, she's not a spare the rod, spoil the child type of person. Go ahead.
No, yeah, I agree. And she was totally fine. She was thrilled that her brother in the show was burned alive.
Yeah. Well, that's
she thought that was great. A cleansing fire.
That's just a testament to her her religious zealotry.
Yeah. But I thought it was a nice. I really like this portrayal of Melisandre, and I thought it was a nice reminder. I think occasionally they need to remind the audience of the rules of this universe, and so it was a nice, pretty jaunty little refresher on the difference between the two main religions. That Melisandre went over.
Right.
To Shireen,
one is so. Lord of Light and one is of Darkness. But that's in contrast. This sort of.
To the seven.
Right. This binary is in direct conflict with the seven, right?
Right.
Yeah. And that was interesting. And it was beautifully shot watching those people get burned alive for sure and horrifying to see and sort of definitely called up like medieval depictions we've seen of that kind of thing. So really well done. Still have no idea where that plot line's going. And speaking of which, we saw Bran again, who looks like exponentially older every single time we see him.
Right.
Like his facial structure is all different now than it was in first season one. We're watching these children grow up before us, and that scene felt like it was like 2 minutes long, right? Like it felt so short. But basically, Bran can't. Oh, actually, no. There was that whole like crazy dream sequence as well. And about how, like, you need to go under the tree or whatever. And we saw footage of Sean Bean, which I believe was from season one. So it wasn't, like, net new Sean Bean footage.
Right.
But not much happens, right? I mean, I don't know how you feel about this plotline, how it's handled in the show, Joanna.
I think it's just really tricky to portray dream sequences in a dynamic fashion on TV. And
well, I don't mind the dream sequences. I think the dream sequences are fine. I think the whole – he is so separated from everything else, like it feels like geographically in the show, that it's just very challenging to care about that character. Like he has done very little of consequence in the last three seasons, right?
Right. But he is – I mean, at least with the Theon stuff this week, we did get a better sense of his importance. Right, because if
he's still alive,
yeah. Right. If the idea is that all the Stark men have been snuffed out, and Sansa's married to a Lannister, and they can't find Arya, then the Starks feel quashed. But if you find out that Bran and Rickon are still scampering around, then that changes things politically.
Right.
So he is important in the political sense. If that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
But in terms of the dynamic storytelling, you know, how can you compare to like dragons over there and people choking on stuff over here, you know, and then Bran's like, oh, then I'm hungry and cold, you know, and it's not as interesting. So,
all right, Joanna. So that's all the other plot lines, and we haven't even gotten to the main event yet. Before we do that, though, we gotta thank our sponsor for this week. People who listen to the Cast of Kings might know that we were kickstarted, and the generosity of our Kickstarter backers allows us to do the show. It also gives us a sponsor every single week. And this year, for the first time, we accepted sponsorship money from a corporate sponsor who chose to look upon our show and say, hey, we want to reach the people, the awesome, intelligent people who are listening to A Cast of Kings. And not only that, they're giving us customized promo codes just for you guys. And each one is a clever reference that I think you guys will like. But what are we talking about here? Who is our sponsor for this week? Well, Jonah Robinson, you know, a podcast like A Cast of Kings, it starts with an idea. It starts with a kernel of an idea that springs forth on the internet and then spreads to the front page of the iTunes podcast page. And how does it do this? It does this through an online address. Now, we use GameOfThronesPodcast.com. But, you know, any idea, like, I actually own, I would say, probably 20 URLs, right? Every time I think of an idea, I buy the URL immediately, right? And the reason for that is because, A, you know, you don't want someone to grab it before you, but B, like, when you have an address URL, you have a starting point, right? And you want to secure a name for it, and you can put anything there. You can put a blog, you can put a website, you can build your own thing, like, and you can forward it to somewhere else like we do it. But it all starts with a great idea and a URL. And I would say that if you have an idea and you want to make it a reality, Hover would be a good way to buy and manage domain names. Hover gives you exactly what you need to get the job done. And a lot of people, like geeks, developers, designers, programmers, they're all talking about Hover because they know they'll have the best tools and support. You don't need to be an expert to get a domain at Hover. If you've never registered a domain before, you'll love Hover as well. It takes a lot of the hassle and friction out of registering a domain. Easy to use, powerful tools to manage the domain so anyone can do it. Guys, let me just say, there's not that many good domain name registrars out there. Like, for the large part, a lot of them are terrible because this is a space that's very difficult to enter. And where people generally don't leave unless they have grievous problems with it. And Hover, above, like out of all that morass, Hover rises above the rest because it is a quality domain name registrar. They are honest. They don't believe in heavy-handed upselling or charging you for something that should just be there. They include everything you need with your domain, no more and no less. They also have awesome customer support. So, we have a promo code that will give you 10% off your first purchase with Hover. And that promo code is hover.com/purple. That's hover.com/purple. That's a customized code just for you guys. And if you are thinking of getting a domain, we would recommend you use hover.com/purple. Again, that's the special domain code just for listeners of A Cast of Kings. Check it out. They do awesome domain management. There's some great sales going on there right now. hover.com/purple. We also rely on the generosity of a bunch of small donors as well, donating $10 each, who we promise to read off on A Cast of Kings. And we promise to try to pronounce your names correctly, but we often fail. Joanna Robinson, who else was a donor to this Kickstarter?
We would like to thank Adriana Rivas, Jan Theodore Marasigan, or it might be Jan, but it might be Jan. We don't know. Michelle Griffin, Trey Smith, Nate Boudreau, Kevin Taylor, Tapio Leopold, Cody Vandenberg, Chad Carius, and then Rosa Endelone, and Justin Beeson. That's a hard one for me this week.
Pretty good. Daryl Williams, Jordan Bliss Treat, Ignacio Ochoa, John Heidman, Patrick Hefner, Chelsea Couch, Kip Pilalis, Vin in Austin, Andre Bergren, Jean Radley Choi, and Stefan Seidel, as well as Nancy Sexton. Thank you guys so much for your contributions to our Kickstarter. And congratulations to Paul and Melanie as well. Got to give a shout out to those guys too. So thank you guys for contributing. Thanks to hover.com/purple for sponsoring us this week. And with all that being said, why is the Hover code purple this week, John Robinson?
I gave this hover code to you weeks ago, did I not?
She gave it to us weeks ago because she knew. I mean, that's what's crazy to me is that you knew it would be the second episode.
I did. I did.
How did you know that? Is it because you read Wikipedia? Like, how did you – did you read the episode guide or did you just guess that that would be it? Like,
I think it had to do with the episode title.
I see.
The Rose, so.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I was ready. I was bracing myself weeks ago for this moment to come. So, and I mean, a bunch of us book readers thought that this was going to close out last season.
Interesting.
You know, because of where it comes in the book. They're shuffling the chronology a bit, which is fine. It works. But this could have easily happened last season. So.
Right. And we're used to something of this magnitude happening towards the end of the season, right? Towards like episode 9. So I'm curious if this is what happens in episode 2, what are they going to stick in episode 9 this year?
Well, it's like last year, Dany, you know, burnt a bunch of people with her dragons in episode 4, I think it was.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, and episode 9 was still more impressive than that. So they have a lot to live up to this year. All right, so we spend the rest of the time this week at King's Landing. A lot of plot lines playing out. You know, we really want to get to the main event, so some of these are probably going to get short shrift, Jonah Robinson. But
you don't want to spend 20 minutes on Shay?
Yeah, so Shay's gone. I don't think anyone really missed that. I mean, that's the problem. I feel like... Really, I think the showrunners want us to feel something at that sort of betrayal, right? But I think by this point, Shay has become such a useless character that I just felt relief that she was gone.
The scene was pretty funny. So I don't know that we've mentioned yet that George R. R. Martin wrote this episode.
Correct.
Right?
And Alex Graves directed, if I'm not mistaken, right?
And he did a great job. The jokes were really good in this episode, I thought, especially like in and around the wedding banquet. But this scene between Tyrion and Shay, where he's basically doing what Arya did to Nymeria, like throwing rocks at the dog that you love, but you want them to go away. It was a little over the top for me, but I don't know. Yeah, that's
it. Wasn't too long ago, I think, in season 2, episode 10, right after the Blackwater, where I found the relationship between Shay and Tyrion quite moving.
Right.
But I guess they kind of flush that character down the toilet, and I don't mean like her moral fiber has gone bad. I just mean that they just didn't give her enough to do that was interesting last season, right? Like even more sympathy with Sansa and like their relationship might have helped to save this character from being a nuisance in my mind. But that's just me. I don't know. Maybe everyone – is there like lots of people out there that love Shay and I'm just kind of infuriating them right now? I don't know.
I think there are people who like Shay more than we do. But I've said before I didn't really love book Shay that much either. So
yeah.
I don't fault the writing or the actress. And yeah.
You don't fault the writing or the actress?
Well, in this scene, I kind of fault the writing, but in general, it's not like they took a beloved character
and made her
unappealing.
Right,
you know?
Right, yep.
So.
Tyrion assigns Bronn to kind of help out Jaime Lannister. Bronn quickly becoming one of the best characters on the show, by the way, if he's not already.
Well, it should be noted, I feel like last week, before we're done with Shay, but yeah. Like last week you said that you didn't think that the handmaiden who reported to Cersei saw anything? Is that what you said? Or
I was kind of being facetious. Like, how much could she have possibly seen is what
right.
I was kind of saying. But, like, obviously it was enough to be really consequential, as we saw. So, like, right. it did not – yeah, it struck me as – I was being facetious last week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And they were Tywin and Cersei were being really evil about it this week. They were like, "That's the woman I told you about. Have her brought to my chamber." You know, like it was kind of like, "Okay, that's
right.
a little over the top." But whatever, she's gone, and I think we're all better off for it.
Good riddance.
Bronn and Jaime are training. I love the way Bronn interacts with Jaime; like he doesn't give a crap who he is,
right.
which is really consistent with Bronn. Jaime trying to learn how to fight with his left hand. I like where that's going. Like maybe what it would be cool to see is Jaime become so good that he's like as good as he was with his left hand. And that would be interesting to see. It is
right hand, yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting that like he brings up that, oh, people would just gossip about the fact that I'm terrible, and that didn't even occur to me. But yes, it does make, because I was thinking to myself, why doesn't Jamie just learn to fight with his left hand? And it's like, well, he just doesn't have that option. Right. So this does sort of address that for sure.
And it's also like, this is a great example of them using a character like Braun, who's so great on the show, so popular with everyone, using him in a scene that's filled, you know, a role that's filled by another character in the book. But you don't need that other character. If you've got this character of Braun, it works much better. And, you know, sometimes I feel like I get accused of like, oh, any change from the book, and I get really upset. But that's not true. This is tidy storytelling, really great.
This
use
is
of
the
Braun.
Exception that proves the rule
this
for Joanna.
This is the only time it's okay.
So we should mention there's that great scene where Joffrey, chops Tyrion's book in half. Very painful to watch. Because actually, I was thinking, oh, maybe they've reached an accord. Maybe this is the episode where they're finally going to patch things up. But nope, that gets...
That was a good fake out.
Yeah, good fake out.
Some good Jack Gleason, the final bastard vestiges of Joffrey. Destroyed a book. How dare he? Yeah. And in George R. R. Martin's book, that book is only one of four copies in the, like, it's a huge crime what he does, destroying that book.
I see.
So,
well, as opposed to in the show, when it's merely just like very embarrassing for everyone at the table, and
really
clearly a huge
upsetting.
Indignity.
Yes. Yeah,
clearly a huge indignity for the crown.
Yeah.
Tywin and Lady Olenna, after the wedding, they have a conversation about... we should mention there's this moment where Sansa says, like, there's a new queen.
Yeah.
Right? And Tyrion says, just be glad it's not you.
Better her than you.
Better her than you, right? Yeah. What did you make of Sansa's statement there? Like, was she... What was her motivation and attitude behind that, what she said?
What do you think? I mean, I think it's possible that there's like a little bit. I mean, not that she's.
Was there a little bit of like, man, I wish that could have been me up there?
Maybe. I mean, just a tiny bit, only because like she was supposed to be the queen.
Right.
And, of the Seven Kingdoms, you know?
And she, and if we recall from season one, that was what she wanted more than anything.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
So it is an interesting little loop around.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure if I got that at all. I mean, at this point, Sansa like has seen, Joffrey force her to stare at her father's decapitated.
Well, not that
head.
She wants to marry Joffrey, but that she was almost queen. Does that make sense? Yeah. She wasn't like, oh, what a wonderful wedding. It was more like, Margaery's now the queen. Okay.
Right.
And it might be a little bit of relief to her also because Margaery has been so kind to her as opposed to Cersei. Right. So there's that.
So a couple other – I think let's just talk about like a few other minor plot details before we get to the big thing. Tywin and Lady Olenna have this conversation where they're talking about how the Iron Bank is going to have its way with King's Landing at some point. This is something that's been referred to in previous seasons about how the Lannisters, despite being incredibly wealthy, like the kingdom is running out of money.
They're in debt. They're heavily in
right,
debt. Yeah.
Heavily in debt. I'm curious, like, how that's going to play out. Is it going to...
But that is, like, a drinking game rule that I would give people. I just feel like the show has tried to make sure we don't forget about this. So every time someone casually in conversation brings up the Iron Bank of Braavos, take a drink.
Interesting. I do wonder, is it going to become consequential, or is it just going to be, like, the U.S. debt to China, where it's just this long-running thing... That just always in the background, but it never actually. It's like an ominous menace that threatens to destroy us. But really, at the end of the day, nothing's going to happen. Okay. I wonder how that's going to turn out. What else? What else happens? We have a nice scene with Oberyn at the wedding. Joanna, this is the episode I found out that apparently the reason Jon Snow's last name is Snow is because that's the name that's given to bastard children in Westeros.
Sure, I've told you that before. I've never said that before.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Well, but that's why it's Ramsay Snow too. Yeah,
Jon Snow,
Ramsay Snow.
But in Dorne, it's the last name is Sand, right? So Snow and Sand.
Right.
And Oberyn and them have this Like, that's the thing about this show, this episode. You know, I tweeted that this was like the game of reaction shots. There were so many reaction shots in this episode. This is like The Office of you know, Game of Thrones. It's just like all these focusing on reaction shots. Tons of reaction shots. People saying inappropriate things, saying awkward things, and these priceless reaction shots from all the characters.
I could just watch that interaction between Tywin and Cersei and Oberyn and Ilaria over and over and over again.
I was thinking of making a supercut of all the reaction shots in this episode, but I decided that it probably would be incomprehensible without the stuff that's actually going on.
Possibly.
So I don't think I'm going to go that route. But so a lot of reaction shots, a lot of great stuff. What was the significance of this Oberyn scene basically just kind of seeding in seeds of discontent? Is that, I mean, there was a lot of like exposition communicated about, oh, like people were basically being incredibly passive aggressive.
So hostile. Yeah. But also, yeah, they brought up something that we actually got some emails about, which was, you were asking me last season about, or last week, about why they would invite the Tyrells at all if they were openly antagonistic. And I forgot to bring up Marcella, who is, you know, one of Cersei's daughter, that Tyrion, when in his capacity as the Hand, as part of a fuck you to Cersei, but also a diplomatic gesture, you know, sold Marcella off to a Prince of Dorne so that, you know, to unite the Baratheon Lannister house to the Dorne house.
Right.
That's a political marriage. So, you know, they kind of have Marcella hostage in Dorne. Not really, but, you know, like as far as these political marriages go. So Oberyn did bring that up. He was like, how fortunate that your daughter is, whatever. I'm not going to do my Chilean accent again because you're going to say it sounds Irish. So we'll move on.
Bastards are born of passion, aren't they? We don't despise them in Dorne.
No, how tolerant of you.
I expect it is a relief, Lady Cersei. Giving up your regal responsibilities. Wearing the crown for so many years must have left your neck a bit crooked.
Suppose you'll never know, Prince Oberyn. It's a shame your older brother couldn't attend the wedding.
Please give him our regards. With any luck, the gout will abate with time and he'll be able to walk again.
They call it the rich man's disease. A wonder you don't have it.
Noblemen in my part of the country don't enjoy the same lifestyle as our counterparts in Dorne.
People everywhere have their differences. In some places, the highborn frown upon those of low birth. In other places, the rape and murder of women and children is considered distasteful. What a fortunate thing for you, former Queen Regent, that your daughter Marcella has been sent to live in the latter sort of place.
I want to bring up the Sigur Rós. Is that how you pronounce it?
It's usually Sigur Rós, from what I understand.
Sigur Rós. That sounds way more Icelandic. Sigur Rós. Cameo at the wedding where they
and played. They're performing a variation of what is it,
of the Reigns of Castamere.
The Reigns of Castamere, right? But it's different lyrics than I think we're used to, right?
Oh, were there different lyrics?
I don't know if it's different. I'm not saying it was different lyrics. I'm saying that like from my recollection, the lyrics that they were singing is different than the ones we're used to hearing. I don't know, like, I know there's many verses to that,
right?
I could be completely wrong. But yeah, and they're using like Sigur Rós style instrumentation as well.
Yeah. And they also played The Bear and the Maiden Fair. Like, basically Westeros has two songs and they play them both at the wedding. Lady Olenna has this great line in the book at the wedding where she goes, I do hope they'll play Reigns of Castamere again. It's been an hour and I forgot how it goes.
Like, nice.
Which they didn't let her have that little zinger in the episode, but yeah, we got another version of Reigns of Castamere, which I really liked. And the other thing I would mention, I guess, is the conversation between Loras and Jaime, which was another great passive-aggressive interchange of, like, you'll never marry her and neither will you. So,
I felt like that moment lessened Jaime in my eyes. It was like a completely, like, idle threat. You know what I mean? Like, from my perspective, it just felt like, what is he trying to say exactly? Like, how is he going to intervene? I don't know. And I guess you're being silent because you're being a good non-spoiler person.
I'm just thinking.
But yeah, I mean, it's just basically Jaime saying, yeah, you're never going to marry her, like, because he's like the spurned boyfriend. He's a spurned ex or whatever in this case. There's also the conversation that Cersei has with Brienne.
Oh, so good.
And I did did not see that coming. I mean, I did not think that Cersei would like have just laid it out there in the open, confronted her straight.
She went there. Gwendolyn Christie is conservatively about 9 feet taller than Lena Headey. Right. It was so great because Cersei was just craning her neck up, but still just like getting her digs in.
Ugh. Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I felt like Cersei was totally in charge of that situation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Brienne's not equipped for that. She's not like a verbal sparrer. And so she's just like, what? No, what? No way.
Yes. Well, I think also that Alan Sepinwall pointed out this in his review, and I felt the exact same thing, which is that I don't think that romantic love really sums up the relationship between Brienne and Jaime.
No.
And I just want to make sure that's clear, because it is kind of implied by Cersei. But I don't think, like, it's far more complex than that, I think.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. Absolutely. And I don't even think that it's not like Brienne's, doodling his initials on her Trapper Keeper or anything like that. It's that...
Because Trapper Keepers haven't been invented yet, right, Jennifer?
Oh, snap. But so when Cersei names it in that way, I think Brienne is able to deny it honestly, but, but that element...
She doesn't deny it, though, does she?
Well, no, but I mean, I think if she were... I mean, I think she could honestly say, I've never... thought of it that way.
Right.
Do you know?
But she didn't.
I owe you my gratitude. You returned my brother safely to King's Landing. Yes,
ma'am. In truth, he rescued me, Your Grace. More than once.
Did he? I haven't heard that story before.
Not such a fascinating story, I'm afraid.
I'm sure you have many fascinating stories. Sworn to Renly Baratheon, sworn to Catelyn Stark, and now my brother. Must be exciting to flit from one camp to the next, serving whichever lord or lady you fancy.
I don't serve your brother, Your Grace.
But you love him.
Your Grace.
So that was awkward.
It was awkward.
Which is too bad, because, I mean, it's just because, I mean, Cersei basically broke up with Jaime already, right? I mean, am I right? So she's still being possessive, though, which I can understand.
I don't know if that's how I would characterize that interchange last week. I mean, I know that was your take on it, but right. I don't know.
Cause, well, he did say, what are you saying? Right. And she never answered him. So.
Right.
So we'll see how that plays out. Anyway. All right, Joanna. So I think we have finally gotten to the thing that...
Wait, no. I have one more thing.
Okay.
Which was what did you think of the War of the Five Kings stunt?
Oh, yeah. Well, what's fascinating about the whole wedding, I mean, it's kind of what I was going to get to, is that...
Okay.
What's cool about this episode is it reminds us of all the reasons why Joffrey is a terrible person.
Right. And his greatest hits, yeah.
His greatest hits, yeah, yeah. And he used, this show to kind of lessen Tyrion, right?
Right. Oh, yeah.
In a really public way. This is the most painfully awkward sort of wedding ever that I've seen, and I've been to some bad ones. I mean, this was, him grandstanding in front of Tyrion and saying terrible things that he knew would incite people. In front of, incite his, worst passions. In front of... hundreds of onlookers, and just tons and tons of uncomfortable silences. Really, really well done. And so, yeah, that was it was meant to be silly, and to make us feel like Joffrey was trying to humiliate Tyrion and succeeding, right?
But as many people as possible, because Sansa too, right? Because that's her brother. Right. Out there, Loras, because Renly's out there, Margaery, because Renly's out there, he basically tried to offend as many people as he possibly could.
Right.
And you have to give it up for Margaery, who's basically the opposite of Bran, who is Margaery's just the most political, most diplomatic, most gracious, always trying to call Joffrey back.
Wait, he's the opposite of Bran?
No, Brienne. She's the opposite of Brienne in that she has all of the social niceties down, you know? And like if I were Kate Middleton of Ingoland, I would watch Margaery's like reel and just emulate that. Not that Kate Middleton needs any help, but I'm just saying. Margaery is like, she's so great in that scene. If you watch it again, she's just doing her best to save everything. So
I agree. I gotta say, credit to Sansa as well, who is, you know, still pretty pissed off about things, but has learned to adapt to the game as well. Right?
Yes, like, correct.
I think Margaery is kind of a more advanced version of Sansa's political game playing. Like,
right.
Sansa has it down, has the basics down. Margaery is playing at a whole freaking other level.
Master
She's like Bobby class. Fischer style, yes. Like five moves ahead. You know what I mean? That kind of level. And Sansa's, you know, just finished learning how to all the moves. A lot of great reaction shots from Sansa this week too. Just horrible atrocities taking place before her and just complete blankness in her expression.
Mm-hmm.
Controlled fury. And controlled anguish, I thought was pretty great. So great performances all around and some great settings all around. So
now we can talk about it.
Now let's talk about the main event, Joanna Robinson. I have a couple of...
You're talking about that pie, right? No, sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say a few things. I'm going to shoot out three thoughts, okay?
I'm ready.
And some of them may be regarded as negative, but listeners should not take these as criticisms. They should take them as observations. Okay. So number one, Alfred Hitchcock once said, do you know what I'm going to say?
Yes.
Alfred Hitchcock once talked about the difference between, suspense and surprise, right? And here's a quote. Four people are sitting around a table talking about baseball or whatever you like. 5 minutes of it, very dull. Suddenly, a bomb goes off, blows the people to smithereens. What does the audience have? 10 seconds of shock. Now take the same scene and tell the audience there's a bomb under the table that will go off in 5 minutes. The whole emotion of the audience is totally different because you've given them that information. In 5 minutes time, that bomb will go off. Now the conversation about baseball becomes very vital because they're saying to you, don't be ridiculous. Stop talking about baseball. There's a bomb under there. You've got the audience working, end quote. And this has been cited many times as the difference between like surprise and suspense. Surprise is, boom, a bomb goes off. Suspense is, you know, the bomb's going to go off in 5 minutes and you see it play out. And for the most part, Joanna, I mean, there is tension at the wedding, but a lot of it is tension that would have existed regardless of whether or not Joffrey is going to get killed at the end of it, right? Like, there's tension of, like, is something crazy going to happen here? Like, is Tyrion going to wig out, like, freak out and just, like, cut someone? Like, is Joffrey going to get pissed off and act out and cut something in half? Like, there's a lot of tension. But for the most part, this plays out like a surprise in my perception. Like, if you don't know that it's coming... If you're like most show watchers and you don't know that Joffrey's going to die this episode, you were probably shocked by how it played out in this episode. For example, like a different way to play this would have been like it's a mission, like someone's mission to assassinate Joffrey. And you know that however Joffrey was poisoned, like whether it was the cup or the cake or whatever or subcutaneous injection, whatever it was, you know that that's what the method the person's using is and you're trying to figure out if they're going to actually achieve it. That's another way this could have played out. It did not play out that way. It played out mostly as a surprise. So I did appreciate that, like, it's more of like a whodunit. It's more of like a mystery. And as a mystery, it was set up pretty well. Like, lots of people had motive. Lots of people had an opportunity. And so it does leave a lot of questions. The other thing I want to say, and then I'll turn it over to you, Joanna Robinson, is one thing is that, like, Game of Thrones, it's really unclear who the protagonist is. Who are we supposed to be rooting for now? But the one thing that was always constant was we knew we were rooting against Joffrey. That's the one single uniting truth of the show. And that is gone now. And so it was incredibly satisfying. And there is much rejoicing, and it's much deserved, and, you know, very cool to see how it played out. But at the same time, I mean, you've lost one of the greatest villains in all of literature / television. And so it's like, how is that going to shift the moral dynamics of the show? I'm very curious. So those are some initial thoughts. What were your thoughts on how this scene happened?
I guess it's hard for me to comment on suspense versus surprise as a show watcher,
right,
because I knew it was coming, but reading the book, it comes out of nowhere. So it's kind of, that's kind of,
I mean, do you agree with my assessment?
That it was more surprise than suspense.
Correct.
I just don't know how many people went into this episode clean, actually.
What do you mean by that?
Given the internet, given how the internet is. And, you know, like, a lot of people were hyping this. I mean, and that's a skewed perception, because my skewed lens is that everyone reads Twitter or goes on Facebook or whatever. And that's not necessarily how most people watch television. But people were talking about this episode, you know, because you could see.
I mean, Joanna, I will tell you, except for one inconsiderate listener, I almost went into this completely clean, like not knowing anything. So that's. And I'm online a lot, so, like, I don't think my experience is atypical.
Okay.
So
I know a lot of people were talking about purple wedding, and it's like, last time this happened, people were like, red wedding.
I literally did not hear of the term purple wedding until after this episode.
Okay.
So,
great.
So that was me.
Good job, everyone. What?
So, no, yeah. So given that, forget about, like, people's perception. Like, how did you experience it?
I don't know. It's kind of impossible. Like, because I knew what was going to happen.
Sure.
So for me, there is that suspense. Do you know? Sort of
right,
built in.
Right.
And I thought they were really faithful to the book, and you know I always like that. So I thought they did a really good job of pulling that off. The hard thing of the medium of the of television versus the book is, by virtue of having to cut a lot of things, they had to show you, if this is a whodunit, they have to show you
all the possible candidates,
right? Suspects and motivation, but they have to do it in a concise way. And so it's even more diluted in the book, right? In the book, you can have a million interactions at that wedding or leading up to it that could point this way or that.
Right.
And here they have to be concise. And so it narrows the field a bit more. And I was actually a little disappointed. Once again, this is skewed through the lens of me working on the internet, but I was a little disappointed with some websites today being a little fast and loose with book knowledge, in my opinion.
Right. In terms of who did it, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Because I love the way it plays out in the books, and I'm protective of people having that experience. You know, I don't want to tell people there's a right way and a wrong way to experience a story, but I would prefer that people either read the book and experience it that way, or watch the show and experience it that way. But to find out about something by clicking on the wrong post, that disappoints me.
Right.
That's someone's experience of discovering this great story.
Yeah. So just be careful. I guess the lesson from this is just be careful. Like, go out there. You know, just because as a
click responsibly,
but, and like, we obviously treat it very seriously. Some people don't treat it as seriously, so just keep that in mind.
But also post responsibly, yeah. I mean, I think there's responsibility on both sides, and I also know that a lot of people don't care at all about spoilers, and that's fine.
And it's like, good for you, but just like, respect people that do. Yeah,
yeah, and I don't know. It might seem like foolish to try to protect people. I don't know. You can stay off Twitter if you want, or stay off the internet if you want. You have that choice. I don't know.
Joanna, you're talking a lot about like the experience around the show, but like,
I think, I think it's worthwhile discussing in the context of this unique situation of a show that is adapted from a book where half the viewers, and it's growing because every season more and more people read the books.
Right.
It's just a unique cultural situation. I know this show is meant to discuss the TV show Game of Thrones, and that's what we try to do. But it's just also something that's on my mind a lot, this idea of this adaptation, this unique way in which the audience is interacting with it. But I'm sorry, I will get back to the point of the show, which is that I thought it was great. I thought the foam and the blood and the like bluish purple hue of Joffrey's face was fantastic. So I thought they did a great job.
I think I have like a couple of complaints from a stylistic standpoint. Firstly, the scene when like Cersei runs up to Joffrey on the ground, and the shots of Cersei, they just looked really awkward for some reason. And that is a really difficult shot to frame, like in reality, because if you think about it, you got a guy who's on the ground and you want someone leaning over them and you want to show the reaction shot. It's just difficult to shoot that. Like, where would you put the camera, right? It's just very challenging. So it did look filmed a little awkward. But the thing that whatever, not a big deal. But the thing that I thought was kind of a big deal was how kind of over the top and ridiculous it was that Tyrion was like in slow motion, like picking up the cup afterwards, being like, what is this that might have killed Joffrey? It's just like, okay, firstly, this is like the second time that Tyrion has gotten framed for the murder of a teenager in the show. Let me just put this out there. I don't know if Tyrion is actually responsible, but I'm guessing he wasn't, because if he was, he would have been smarter than what he did and then picking up the cup afterwards and looking super guilty. That's just my opinion. I have no actual knowledge. But yeah, I've just thought it was a little over the top how it kind of was like, guilty, guilty. He's wearing a guilty sign. And even if he is guilty, that's like, it's still too over the top for me. So I thought the way the show, so those are my only complaints about the scene, but everything else I thought was masterful. A lot of people had motive and opportunity, and it wasn't clear like what the actual agent was that poisoned him, right? Like, it could have been the cup, it could have been the cake. It could have been something in the fork that Margaery used to put the cake in Joffrey's mouth. Like, it could have been a lot of things. It could have been Ser Dantos. Ser Dantos certainly seemed pretty freaking guilty. If he wasn't the perpetrator, he certainly seemed like he probably knew what was coming. So that's my observation.
This is where I'm going to do like a short dramatic reading from the book.
Please.
I just want everyone to enjoy the description of Joffrey dying in the book, which is pretty short. But it says, Joffrey began to claw at his throat, his nails tearing bloody gouges in the flesh. Beneath the skin, the muscles stood out hard as stone. Prince Tommen was screaming and crying. And I think I read a bit from The Red Wedding, too. Just, you know, people get a little squeamish about the violence on the show, and I just want to let you know that it is nothing compared to what is described in the book. If we had watched Jack Gleason sort of tear his own throat out, that would have been a little more upsetting. And then this part, just to address what you just said, because this chapter is from Tyrion's perspective, and it says, but his eyes fell on the wedding chalice forgotten on the floor. He went and scooped it up. There was still a half inch of deep purple wine in the bottom of it. Tyrion considered it a moment, then poured it on the floor. You know, so I feel like they just lifted it directly. And I don't know if that has to do with George R. R. Martin writing this episode. But you know, I hear what you're saying, but also when it's lifted directly from the book, I have a hard time complaining about it. So
I don't.
I know.
You know, I was reading this interview with George R. R. Martin, which I like kind of skimmed because it looked kind of spoilery. Entertainment Weekly, what remains of them anyway, does some pretty great interviews with George R. R. Martin after like hugely consequential episodes. So they did one after The Red Wedding. They did one after this episode as well. And something that he said that I thought was awesome was he's talking about how The Red Wedding was already like a really shocking moment, but that the showrunners like upped the ante by showing the death of Robb Stark's wife and unborn child.
Yeah.
So did you find the sort of violence in this scene, like, it sounded like you were implying that it was actually more violent in the book than it was in the show. I mean, did you think that this show did an overall faithful job of representing the Purple Wedding?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's nothing, but you don't think that they did anything to up the ante or anything?
No. I mean, other than, no.
Okay. Just wondering. Because they did with The Red Wedding. So,
Yeah. They did on the one hand, but on the other hand, like I said, I think if you read The Red Wedding, the description of Catelyn, like, it's upsetting to watch Michelle Fairley's throat get slit on screen.
Right.
but it is actually much more upsetting to read about the knife like sawing into her throat, if that makes sense. It right. just is, you know, the language is just more descriptive and upsetting. Right. So yeah, they up the ante by adding this entirely like, you know, new character and stabbing a pregnant woman. You and I had a long conversation about that, but I just think, you know, this is me, like, this is my bookseller, book reader soapbox moment. Like, reading it is always going to be more visceral. Well, as long as the writing is as good as what George R. R. Martin does, it's always going to be more visceral than watching it transpire quickly in front of your eyes on screen.
Interesting. Interesting.
In my opinion. So. This is me just trying to convert more book readers every year. So.
There you go. You know, someone actually wrote in asking if I would ever read the books. And I've considered this, and Joe and I think we have actually talked about this.
Yeah, we did talk about it this year.
And about whether like I'd be okay to read like the first three books, for instance, right. or the first two books. And I think we both agreed it would compromise the nature of the Cast of Kings podcast.
Your like, purity.
The purity. Yeah, right. So I'm going to try to stay away from the books until the show is at an end. But I'm definitely, you know, like hearing you talk about it, hearing you read from it, you know, hearing people rave about it, hearing all the smugness from book readers, I definitely want to join that club, you know, of people who know things that other people don't. So overall, I thought it was really effective. I am curious, like, yeah, where do they go from here? This kind of, a few observations that people have made. Marjorie, really unlucky in terms of marriages. This will be her second unconsummated marriage, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, the fourth wedding we've seen on screen in Game of Thrones. I'm thinking of Daenerys' wedding. I'm thinking of Rob and Talisa's. I'm thinking of the Red Wedding, and I'm thinking of the Purple Wedding. I don't think I'm missing any, but let me know if I am.
Tyrion and Sansa.
Tyrion and Sansa, that's right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a memorable one as well. And let's say like every one of those has either ended horribly or been a marriage that has ended horribly or been resulted in a horrible marriage. So
I don't know, Tyrion's pretty nice to Sansa.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Although we have no idea where that's going. You know, Rob and Talisa,
No, point taken. There aren't a lot of romantic happy ever afters in Game of Thrones.
Right. Although, to be fair, according to Dothraki standards, the Purple Wedding was still a dull affair.
It was.
So, I mean, I thought it was a great episode. You know, as I said in the early part of this podcast, like a lot of time spent at King's Landing gives you this room to breathe, a lot of intersecting plot lines. It just felt like some really masterful sequences played out here. Really great dialogue, pays off a lot of the character work that we know from people, the relationship between Tyrion and Joffrey and how tense that is, and a really satisfying death in the end. But the thing is, like, the way... Okay, and let's put this out there too. The way that Joffrey died, you know, it was...
No way, Dave. No way.
It was kind of a tiny bit sad, was it not?
Oh.
What? What were you? What did you think I was going to say?
Oh, I thought you were going to say it was like a letdown or...
No, not at all, not at all.
I was like, you're going to get lit?
No. I did not think it was a letdown, but, you know, this also comes...
His parents were right there, sort of cradling him as he died, like that. That was kind of touching.
Yeah. I mean, that was terrible.
His parents / uncle, yeah.
And, you know, again, going back to what George R. R. Martin said, quote, "I think Joffrey is a classic 13-year-old bully. Do you know many 13-year-old kids you'd like to give absolute power to? There's a cruelty in children, especially children of a certain age. We don't want 13-year-old bullies to be put to death. We probably do when we're their 13-year-old victims, but they grow up and most of them grow out of it, and sometimes people do regret their actions. Joffrey will never get that chance, so we don't know what he would have become. Probably nothing good, but still." And he also end quote, and he also goes on to say, like, how you kind of feel, you know, that at the end of the day, it's a child dying in the arms of his mother, right? And
which even, is more, we talked about this last week with Arya, the age difference matters here. Jack Gleason is older than 13, and so it's not a 13-year-old. You know what I mean? If it it would be different.
I was actually going to say, like, I still think it was effective. Like, you do... I guess when I watched the scene, like, my first impulse wasn't, yeah, Joffrey's dead. You know? Like, it wasn't... Like, I wasn't celebrating like I know a lot of people on Twitter were. I was, I don't know.
Because you're deeper, man.
I'm not trying to elevate my opinion above other people. I'm just saying, like, that wasn't my first inclination. It was that, wow, like, that's kind of sad.
That's why they chose that funereal Reigns of Castamere to play over the end credits. I think a lot of people wanted it, like a more fist pumping song to play.
Here's another quote from George R. R. Martin. Joffrey, as monstrous as he is in the books, he's a 13-year-old kid, and there's a kind of moment where he knows that he's dying and he can't get a breath, and he's kind of looking at Tyrion and at his mother and at the other people in the hall with terror and appeal in his eyes, you know, saying, "Help me, mommy, I'm dying." And in that moment, I think even Tyrion sees a 13-year-old boy dying before him. So I didn't want it to be entirely, "Hey ho, the witch is dead." I wanted the impact of the death to strike home on perhaps more complex feelings on the part of the audience, not necessarily just cheering, end quote. And I guess if that was his intention, it really worked for me. Like, I was not just rejoicing that this terrible person had died. I was thinking, you know, who killed him? And it kind of sucks that this kid had to die because he was such a terrible human being.
I don't know. I think they made Joffrey enough of a monster in the show. And since Jack Gleason is 21, my feelings were a lot less complicated. Having Joffrey, you know, kill Roz the way he did, like just all the stuff that they did to make sure that you hated him so that, you know, I don't know. I don't know what their intention was there. The other thing I want to say, the other feeling I was having is a little bit of relief for Jack Gleason, who has said for a while now that he wanted to retire when he was done. And I was like, oh, good. He finally gets to retire. Like, that's what he's been wanting ever since he got, like, more famous than he wanted to be, basically. So,
I mean, we should say it is a masterful performance that he gave.
Absolutely.
And one of the most memorable on-screen villains in the history of, you know, any medium, I would argue, right? Like, up there with Heath Ledger and the Joker, up there with, you know, name any other villain, I would put this up there with them as one of the most, the best, occasionally nuanced performances, but certainly one of the most hated characters that people just loved to hate.
Yeah.
And that was still, like, fairly plausible. Like, he was kind of over the top in his cruelty, but he was never over the top in a way that I felt like a person in his situation would never be this way. Do you know?
Like, right. He's a little boy king. He's a tyrant. Yeah.
I felt like we were watching, you know, the male teenage id play itself out on the Iron Throne. And,
right.
And it never felt like he struck a wrong note there. It always felt like this is totally plausible to me.
Yeah.
So it's one of the greats, and he did an amazing job. And he, you know, whether people want to admit it or not, he will be missed. So.
Oh, absolutely. But to address that question you had, you know, it strikes me as similar to the question of season one of what are we going to do without Ned Stark as our hero? What are we going to do without Joffrey as our villain? And I'm not saying that, you know, Jack Gleason won't be missed or that Joffrey won't be missed as a great character, but this is basically a Hydra situation where you cut off a head and, you know, like there's always going to be nasty people in Westeros and Essos for us to root against.
Indeed. So. Hail Hydra. So I think that's going to wrap us up for today, Joanna?
Yep.
All right. So Joanna Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
Every day on VanityFair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Congratulations, Paul and Melanie.
Find me at DaveChen.net and at Dave Chensky on Twitter. That's Dave Chen, SKY. And also follow me on Facebook at Facebook.com/ChenDavid. Thank you guys for tuning into A Cast of Kings. We will see you guys next week.